Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Two education bills have drawn enormous attention in the legislature this year. First was SB 193, allowing families to spend most of the state's per-pupil public education grant on alternatives, including private school tuition or homeschooling. This generated a huge philosophical, legal, and financial debate. And then, while that dispute was simmering, another controversial education measure was put in the pot to increase oversight of homeschooling. It's an idea discussed in many states this year after severe abuses revealed in California. But in New Hampshire, the bill's first hearing attracted crowds of opponents. Today in The Exchange, we study up on both of these bills and whether they'll pass or fail in the legislature this year. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, it's exchange@nhpr.org. Or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are two reporters who cover education. They are Jason Moon, who covers education for us here at NHPR. Jason, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Lola Dufort. She covers education for the Concord Monitor. Lola, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
And let's start with SB 193, because that came up very early in the session, one of the first bills that they looked at, and has since gone through lots of twists and turns. And Jason, just give us the very basics of this bill, please.
Yeah, so as you said, it would allow some parents to take the public state tax dollars that normally follow a child to a public school. They could then spend that money on educational alternatives like private school education, like homeschooling costs. There's actually a kind of a handy list that's included in the bill. It's kind of like a shopping list of things you can spend it on. And so it's everything from transportation to and from tutoring to online learning to private school tuition. So that's the basic. It's similar to a voucher system in that way. It's the money that normally follows a child to a public school, but this bill would give almost all that money to the parent and let them to decide among this list of options, basically.
About 90% the total. So about roughly $3,000, we're talking about?
It's
Jason?
About $3,500. So it's the base rate of the adequacy funding for people who know or are familiar with how public schools are funded in New Hampshire. The state pays about $3,500 per kid at a public school. That's the base rate. You get a little extra if you're English learner, if you are behind on your third grade learning, reading level, things like that. So it can be more. And under this bill, parents would get that extra money too. But for the base rate, it's $3,500 per kid per year.
And you gave us a list of what parents could spend it on, Jason. Who's eligible? Because that has changed a lot since this bill was first introduced. At first, it was anybody who wants it.
That's right, pretty much anybody. Yeah, that's one of the biggest changes that we've seen since the bill was introduced almost a year ago. In January of 2017, it was first introduced. And that is one of the big things that they've workshopped over the last year. And as it's written today, here's who's eligible. You have to be a student in public school for at least a year.
So you can't start off your public school career with
you can't.
Money
you can't.
From,
that's included.
So private.
You have to be in public school for a year, or you're starting kindergarten. So not if you're homeschooling. Basically, is who that excludes. So you're not eligible for this program if you're already a homeschooler. You have to be in public school for a year, or you're a kindergartner, or you'd be starting in kindergarten. You have to be that and meet one of the following criteria. You have to be low income, household income below 300% of the federal poverty line, or you're attending a public school that's identified as a failing 2 years in a row, you have an IEP, or you applied for another school choice program and didn't get it. So you try to get into a charter school, or you try to get an education tax scholarship funding. So there's lots of different ways. You have to be in public school, and then one of these four options. And supporters of the bill say that that leaves about half of all students eligible. So
that's what I was going to ask you. How many people are we talking about? Yeah, go ahead.
Still pretty broad, but it's down from a universal program to about half of all students based on the criteria that it's laid out.
So that's changed a lot since it was first introduced.
It is a big change. It's still, as these systems go, as education savings account systems go, it's still pretty broad compared to what other states have done, but it is a lot more targeted than it once was.
Lola, who's been behind this bill?
So Republican leadership has been behind this. Obviously, Governor Sununu has come out, and he's come out in support of this since eligibility has been restricted. You have national school choice groups, which have been really active in the State House. You have EdChoice, which is like formerly the Milton Friedman Foundation for Education. You have the Institute for Justice, which is this libertarian law firm, and they worked with the Josiah Bartlett Center to write about the constitutionality of this. Jeb Bush briefly weighed in.
Really?
He submitted an op-ed to the Concord Monitor and Union Leader last year. I don't know how involved his think tank is still. And then obviously you have supporters on the ground.
Supporters on the ground who want this to go to give people, they say, more opportunity.
Right. You often see families come to these committee hearings to say, you know, I would like this escape hatch.
Who's been against this bill?
Pretty universally, the public school community. So, you know, the superintendents, the teachers' unions, also a lot of grassroots opposition. I think that's about it in terms of the major parties.
And when people looked at the bill early on, Jason mentioned the twists and turns that this bill has gone through, both in terms of the funding and who's eligible. Is there anything else that you think we should know, Lola, about how this bill has evolved since it was introduced early this year?
I mean, the eligibility is interesting because we know that as a minimum, 84,000 kids qualify. And that's just like the two major categories. That's if you're low income or if you have a special education plan. But more could be, and that's because it's really hard to know how many kids fall under the other criteria. And that's, you know, if you applied to a charter school and didn't get in, or you applied to an education tax credit and you didn't get it. And then also the language in the bill about being a low-performing school, I think there's a lot of confusion about what that would mean at this point.
Because that's another criteria that would allow you to access these funds.
Exactly. So we know that as a base, 84,000 kids qualify, but the total number is kind of unknowable.
I want everyone to know that we're talking about two bills this hour, but for the moment, we're talking about SB 193. And as our guests have been telling us, this would allow families to use school tax dollars to fund alternatives for their kids. So we're talking about that for the next few minutes. And then a little bit later in the show, we'll talk to a bill that would increase accountability and oversight for homeschoolers. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Jason, go ahead. I can see you want to jump in there.
Yeah, so another big change to the bill that could be even more significant than the changes in eligibility are the inclusion of these hold harmless grants. So the main criticism of this bill so far has been this is going to suck money away from the public school system. With each kid that leaves, their state grant is leaving, and you can't always, you know, ramp down your costs at the same rate that you're losing state money. The new provision in this bill would ensure that no public school would lose more than 0.25% of its state aid each year. So that's new money. So if 20%, this is a totally hypothetical situation, but if 20% of kids in a particular public school decided to take advantage of this program, they would lose 20% of their public funding, but then they'd get a grant to cover all but 0.25%. That's a lot. It's a little complicated, but no school is going to lose more than 0.25% of their state aid from the adequacy grants under this bill.
That has to do with the concern, Lola, right, that schools had that if 20% of kids all of a sudden went somewhere else, the school would be left with a lot less money.
Right. Technically, it's a 0.25% of their total budget.
That's right.
But, yeah, I mean, which has added the whole question of, like, how much is this going to cost in new money for the state? I mean, schools are still complaining that the losses would hurt. But yeah, it's added this whole new dimension of how much does the state want to allocate in terms of extra funding for this program.
Well, and supporters would say, right, Lola, that, hey, if 20% of your students leave, you know, maybe your costs don't go down by 20%, but they go down by a lot because you've got fewer kids to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. As supporters of this bill say, you know, would this hold harmless? You know, you could see schools saving lots of money because they'll be able to recover their costs when a huge amount of kids leave or when a certain amount of kids leave.
All right. Well, I want to play a little bit from one of the hearings on this bill, on this financial argument and the concerns that you guys have said schools have raised. Here's State Board of Education Chair and Interim President of the Josiah Bartlett Center, Drew Klein, saying that SB 193 would not seriously harm school budgets.
Based on realistic projections of a first-year impact, school districts in New Hampshire, on average, would keep 99.8% of their operating budgets.
Again, that's Drew Klein, State Board of Education Chair, talking about SB 193 and the possible impact on school budgets. I want to play another clip, though, from that same hearing. This is Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig, and this raises a concern that I have heard elsewhere that big cities might not do so well under this bill because they have a lot of schools deemed underperforming. Let's hear from newly elected Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig.
The bill before you today, if passed, will cause harm to the Manchester School District, our 14,000 students and parents like me who pay taxes and want the best opportunities for our children.
Again, that's Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig speaking about SB 193 at a hearing earlier this year. And that's what we're looking at during this part of our show today in the Exchange. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So we got a couple emails before the show, guys, and here's one from Margaret in West Lebanon. Now, she makes a couple points, but especially on this issue of money, she says stabilization grants may cost the state up to $31 million in new spending over 5 years. There's no plan as to where this money would come from. She also says SB 193 would have a disproportionate impact on cities and property-poor districts. Jason, can you address those two points that Margaret raises? First of all, that there's no plan yet as to where these stabilization grants monies would come from.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the bill is now. It's in the House Finance Committee, and that's one of the major issues they're grappling with. Because there are these grants now included in the bill, there's money attached to it. When it was first introduced, it was revenue neutral, right? You were just taking money that would normally follow a kid to public school and sending it to a different, you know, educational outcome. Now you're doing that, but then the public school is also getting a grant to cover their losses. So how much this bill is going to cost and you know, what the impacts are going to be down the road is a huge question. And it's, you know, it's basically all about take-up rates. How many kids are going to use this program?
And we don't know.
And it's hard to tell. I mean, you look at other states, and the number's usually, you know, 1%, 3%, somewhere around there. But, you know, we're trying to forecast into the future, you know, how many kids per year are going to be taking this program. And the reason that cities in particular are concerned, like in Manchester, for example, is they're already facing this trend of declining enrollment, which has been a huge strain on their budget without this bill. They see it as just another thing adding on that's going to draw more students away from their system. And they have all these fixed costs, like, you know, capital and building costs and things like that. And they say, you know, maybe we're only going to lose 0.25%, but when your budget is as big as Manchester's, 0.25% is like $400,000 or something like that. And they say that's not easy for us to swallow. So that's sort of where a lot of those things combine.
Go ahead, Lola.
Yeah, and cities like Manchester also just have a higher number of kids that would be eligible, we know for sure, right? Because more than 50% of their kids are on free and reduced lunch. So they're automatically eligible. Which is different than, you know, a place like Bow or Bedford.
Right. And you said earlier, one of you said earlier, that low income is one of the qualifying.
One of the criteria, yeah.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you for the email, Margaret. Here's another one from Ray, who says, a parent guardian wants to send their children to private school, no problem. A parent guardian wants to homeschool their children, no problem. But Ray says, I do not want one penny of whatever my taxes goes to the state to help defray their costs. New Hampshire has an excellent public school system, Ray says. If it is not good enough for these parents, let them pay for themselves. So that's one sentiment. But Lola, on the other side, what sentiments did you hear from people saying they wanted a choice for their kids and that they couldn't afford it?
Yeah, I mean, you heard many families come to committee hearings saying, my kid flourished in a private school after they didn't get what they needed. You know, you often hear about kids just kind of not getting the individualized attention that they need in classrooms where there are, you know, 20 to 30 kids. And, you know, proponents of this will say, the rich can afford a private option, but I can't. And I'd like that option for my kid.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Something else that's come up around this bill, SB 193, that I want to ask both of you about. In addition to the financial questions and the stabilization grants and how much they would help and where the money would come from, there's been a constitutional issue, Lola, and I'd love to ask you about that. What's been said about the legality, constitutionality of this bill?
Yeah, so opponents of this say that it is completely unconstitutional, and that's because it would allow parents to use these accounts to spend money at religious schools. And New Hampshire's constitution has an explicit prohibition against this. Proponents say that it's fine, and that's because – so the interesting thing about ESAs is they were actually invented as a legal workaround to constitutional challenges that vouchers had come up against. The first one was created in Arizona in 2011, and this was after the court there had found a voucher program unconstitutional because it sent money to religious schools.
So other states have this prohibition as well.
Yes. So they're usually called Blaine Amendments. Those are, you know, the clauses in state constitutions that explicitly prohibit this. And so ESAs are a legal strategy for getting around this. Whether or not that could be successful here, we won't really know until it comes before the state Supreme Court. But so parties like the ACLU will say you can't do something indirectly, which you can't do directly. You know, it's you can't just launder money through a scholarship organization and call it constitutional. Proponents say that this is a legal strategy that has worked elsewhere. Nevada is a really interesting case where the state has a similar prohibition, and the state Supreme Court there said we buy this argument. And that's because ESAs are structured differently than a voucher. The money would go to a scholarship organization and into an account called an educational savings account. And then parents would be able to use that money towards any of these expenses.
So it's one step removed.
Exactly. And the legal argument is we're not giving money to a religious school. We're giving money to parents, and parents make the decision.
I see. So that legal argument has worked in some other states where they have this prohibition against public monies going to religious schools.
Yes. Whether or not it would work in New Hampshire will be up to the New Hampshire Supreme Court if it, you know, gets before them.
If this bill were to become law, and then that's a big if given some of the financial concerns.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much support for it that I think there's a very good chance it will become law. What it will look like, especially in terms of whether or not there'll be any sort of cap on the number of kids that can use it, I think that's the greater question. But,
okay.
I mean, of course, it could be blocked.
It sounds like there's a couple more questions that I need to ask both of you about this bill, including some of the legal issues and where it goes forward. And then after we're done with that, we will turn to another bill that generated an enormous outpouring a week or two ago. And that has to do with greater accountability measures for homeschoolers. So we'll talk about that, too, in a few minutes. And keep taking your emails. So send them in, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today, we're sitting down with two education reporters to look at two controversial bills in the legislature. One, SB 193, would allow families to use school tax dollars for alternative education. The other, that we'll talk about in a few minutes, would increase accountability for homeschoolers. Let's hear from you on these. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Our two education reporters are Lola Dufort with the Concord Monitor and Jason Moon with us here at NHPR. And Jason, I'd love your thoughts, too, on what we heard from Lola before the break. Real interesting that some states have tried these education savings accounts and have run into constitutional problems concerning the prohibition of giving public money to religious schools, but then have found a way to work around that.
Yeah, it'll be a really interesting debate if it ends up in the state Supreme Court, which it very likely will. And it really gets at this the question of these Blaine Amendments, which you know, supporters of a bill like this say, they point to the history of these amendments. They say that they were basically anti-Catholic amendments passed in the 19th century and that they're antiquated and out of date. And, you know, this is just one way of kind of chipping away at them. And it really, as Lola was saying, it really does kind of come down to where you place the agency in the transaction. So they say that we're giving the money to parents and then it's the parents that are choosing. It's not the state, you know, condoning a religion or choosing a favorite, you know, establishing a state religion, right, like the Constitution would clearly bar. So they say it's like a Pell Grant, per se, or like the GI Bill. You could use that at a religious school because it's your choice. It's not the state picking. Opponents say this is just a clear attempt to get around a law that says you can't use public money in religious schools. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how New Hampshire comes down on that. As Lola was saying, other states have, at least one, has given the okay to this education savings account strategy as a way to do this. We could be the next one.
And the Catholic Diocese, right, Lola, is a supporter of this bill.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of enthusiasm with the with religious schools in the state, especially because tuition at, you know, these smaller, largely Catholic schools is much cheaper. You know, they're anywhere between like $5,000 to $10,000, and an ESA would be anywhere between $3,500 and $8,000.
So that would go a long way.
So that could completely cover your tuition. That's not going to cover your tuition at a Tilton or a Kimball Union. So the greatest enthusiasm for this bill has been in that sector where, you know, I think they see that they're likely to be the greatest beneficiaries of this. And if you look at the Education Tax Credit Scholarship, which is a similar program in New Hampshire, the vast majority of scholarships have gone to these religious schools, these smaller religious schools.
Partly probably for that practical reason, right, Lola? I mean, Derryfield costs $32,000 a year.
Exactly.
As you said, Catholic schools, $5,000 to $10,000 a year. So $3,500, yeah, goes a long way.
Exactly.
You mentioned, Lola, earlier that despite the financial concerns about this bill, the stabilization grants and where the money would come from, there's a lot of support and that this might actually pass.
Yeah, I mean, the governor has come out in support of this. Leadership is in support of this. I think the only thing that could hang it up is whether or not they can resolve their financial concerns about the bill, because the stabilization, which is the reimbursements to schools, were really crucial at getting Republican moderates on board for the bill, who were beforehand, you know, really worried about the impact this would have on public schools. I've spoken to multiple, you know, Republicans that have sat on school boards before this bill was amended who were really concerned about this.
Here's another email that came in. This is from Beth, who says, with this bill, New Hampshire legislators increase costs to local taxpayers instead of supporting their efforts to build the best possible education in their communities. Beth says this bill turns parents away from forming a partnership with teachers and the school community, offering parents the choice of a school setting, promoting various kinds of segregation instead of investing in the amazing opportunity to participate in democracy. Beth says it's an unfair law that leaves out the poorest and most needy students. Jason, can you talk about that? Because supporters of this bill say, no, this is exactly people we're helping. Look at the criteria.
Right. They would say it's targeted at low-income students. You could rebut, well, what about things like transportation costs? How are you going to get there? Or, you know, what if it doesn't cover the full, you know, cost of tuition? And how are you going to make up that extra mile? But it just gets back to the broader, larger kind of philosophical debate here about public education. And, you know, a lot of public school proponents, they look at a bill like this and see it as just another example of the chipping away of the public school system, this drive towards a privatization of education. I think that's the big fear. And from their perspective, they say, these school choice initiatives, taking money out of public school, we should just be investing all that in one public school system that treats every student equally, and they're worried about programs like this that, in their eyes, will create unequal systems where some students are getting, you know, have more access to certain rights or certain types of learning than others, and that's what they're afraid of. On the other side, obviously, you have parents who say, "I tried the public school system; it didn't work for my kid."
Yeah, my kid is stuck in an underperforming
school. Exactly. And that language of escape hatch is often used. Like, we need another option; it's not working here. We're looking for something else. So we did homeschooling, we did private school. You know, we need some help to take advantage of those options, and this bill would give us that.
Well, Beth, thank you for the email, and to you, Lola, first. But as attention has turned to the fiscal impact of this, there have been dueling analyses, and you guys have my sympathy for trying to keep track of these. Who's been estimating how much this might cost, Lola, and how do we even begin to figure that out?
Yeah, so you're right. There have been dueling analyses, and I think there will be more. So the Reaching Higher Education, which is a public education, public school advocacy organization, they came up with $31 million over 5 years. Bill Duncan, who's on the state board and who's with another public ed advocacy group, has come up with some pretty startling numbers, where it could get to up to like $74 million in a single year. The legislative budget assistant, which is the state's kind of nonpartisan number cruncher on bills, has come up with 36 over 12 years. And I know the Josiah Bartlett Center is working on their own analysis. I haven't seen it yet. Maybe it's been released.
It's hard to say, though, isn't it? Because we don't know how many kids would actually take advantage of
this. Yeah, it all boils down to how many kids will take advantage, right? Like, everyone can kind of agree on the basic formula and the math. What they can't agree on is how many kids will actually use it. And I think that's fairly unknowable. There was this really interesting kind of back and forth at the House Finance Committee where Bill Duncan was, testifying about his model, and Representative Wheeler was like, I don't buy these numbers. I think you're just an opponent. And they had this kind of testy back and forth. And Bill Duncan was like, look, whether or not you believe my numbers, if you just want to make sure this doesn't happen, then cap it. And, Rep. Wheeler said, we probably will. And so
cap the number of students who are eligible.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think there's a good chance something like that will happen. But I talked to Representative Umberger, who's the chairwoman of the kind of subcommittee that's taking a deep dive at these numbers. And she said, even with the lowest estimate that we've seen so far, which is the LBA's estimate,
Legislative Budget Assistant.
Assistant, yeah. She said, I'm still kind of nervous about these numbers. So
it sounds like a cap may be in order.
I think that might happen. I mean, we can't know yet. And they might ultimately think that these numbers won't come to be, or that New Hampshire can afford $36 million over 12 years.
All right. I want to turn the corner in just a minute on this homeschooling bill. But one last email on this SB 193, Deanna sent us an email from Portsmouth. And Deanna, I can't read the whole thing on the air, but basically she describes how her daughter spent time in both public and private education. And Deanna says, I value having options. However, she says, I feel that moving public money to private institutions which are not similarly required to serve every child and meet all their needs is ill-advised. Deanna says any use of public funds for private education should come with the same mandates that the public system is subject to. Free lunch, special ed services, medical staff, standardized testing, minimum number of days, staff certification. Deanna says any voucher system should require equity, equal access, no application, and equal mandates, no exceptions. Now, Jason, this would be a tall order for some private schools if, you know, I took my grant and, you know, tried to send one of my children to a private school. It'd be a tall order for them to change some of these rules and regs that they don't have to meet right now.
Yeah, I think a lot of private schools wouldn't accept the money. They wouldn't be interested.
If it came with all those strings attached.
Right. And I think supporters of a bill like this would say, well, that, you know, in some way defeats the whole purpose of the private school system, where you can have schools make decisions, to be different. But that is one of the main areas of concern that we haven't really gotten into, which is, you know, what kinds of protections do kids get if they go to a private school with this public money? Are the schools required to adhere by all of the same, you know, disabilities rights laws and equity laws? I've seen some bills filed this session that would force schools that receive money through programs like this to follow those. I don't think they have much of a future. They're all, they're sponsored by Democrats and Democrats alone.
Basically saying, okay, private and religious schools, if you want to accept this education savings account money, you have to adhere to all the regulations that Deanna mentions in her email.
And again, parents who want to send their kids to private schools say, look, we were at the public school where they had all these so-called protections and we still didn't like it. So that's the other side of the coin.
Okay. Go ahead, Lola.
Yeah, there's been some really interesting reporting nationally about these programs and kids with special education plans where you had parents that, opted to try these programs because, they found that their kids weren't getting the help they needed and then couldn't find a private school that would accept them and ended up back in the public school system.
Because, again, the private schools can say, no, we don't want you.
Right. You also have a lot of parents that say, like, look, my kid had a disability and it wasn't being addressed properly in a public school. And then they flourished despite not having an IEP in a public school, in a private school.
Because they got that attention.
Yeah. I think the concern for critics of this bill is that the kids with the most complicated and difficult to accommodate disabilities will necessarily end up stay in the public sector, while those with less difficult disabilities to accommodate, could leave, and that segregative effect is itself bad will negatively impact kind of just the atmosphere in schools and the ability of those kids to learn.
Last question for you on this, and then we will turn to the homeschooling bill. Lola, if SB 193 that we've been talking about is signed by the governor, does it end up in court?
Almost certainly.
Really? Because that's what you've seen in other states?
Yeah. It will end up in court. No one said, the ACLU hasn't said explicitly that they will sue, but I think we can have either they will or the union will. There's a possibility that it could get thrown out for a standing question, right? The Education Tax Credit Scholarship ended up in the courts, and the state Supreme Court ultimately threw it out, not because of the religious issue, because you can use the money in an education tax credit to go to a religious school, but just because they said the person who was suing didn't have standing, right, couldn't show harm. So I think that's a concern that a lot of people have about whether or not they'll be able to successfully litigate this program.
All right. Well, let's turn to the other education bill that has also been keeping you guys busy, and that is a bill that would increase accountability, oversight of homeschooling. This is House Bill 1263, described in the bill language as increasing accountability measures for homeschoolers. And just to kick it off, I want to play a little bit from this huge hearing that was held. There was regular hearing was supposed to be held, and there were so many people who showed up that they had to move it into Representatives Hall. because there was such a crowd. Let's hear Representative Edith Tucker. Here she is introducing House Bill 1263 at the hearing. And Representative Tucker tried to say to the big group gathered there, look, this is not aimed at the vast majority of homeschooling families who are working hard for their kids.
This bill addresses how we can make sure that we find those children whose parents aren't teaching them at home and make it so that they are educated citizens.
Now, both of you were at that hearing. Jason, what was it like?
Well, I think Representative Tucker may have been the only person who spoke in favor of the bill that day. You mentioned it was such a crowd that they had to move it to Reps Hall, and that was largely because there were so many homeschool families there and homeschool children filling the seats in Reps Hall, you know, all there to oppose the bill, which would force parents of homeschoolers to share the results of the evaluations, the yearly evaluations that the law says they're already supposed to be doing, but they don't right now. They don't have to share them with anybody. They're just for their own benefit. The bill in question would force them to share it with either the state commissioner of education or a non-public school principal. I think there are some other options, but that's what they're arguing about here. But as the crowd, you know, told us that there's quite a bit of opposition from those who are in the homeschool community.
What kind of accountability are they talking about, Lola?
It's basically that. It's just showing the evaluation that you already do either to a non-public school principal, the Department of Education, or your local district. And if your child is not found to be making adequate progress, the parent can be kind of put on probation for a year. And then if the kid isn't showing any progress, then the homeschool program can be terminated. And that's what really spooks these parents, the idea that all of a sudden this third party could say you're not doing your job. You know, they say it's intrusive and not necessary. And that's not surprising given that a homeschooling family kind of by definition feels like they can do a better job than the party that this bill says would have all of a sudden oversight over them. So that's, yeah.
Well, and as you both said, there are a lot of people, a lot of homeschooling families, kids at this hearing. Let's hear from one of them. This is Melissa Theberge. She's a homeschool parent of three, speaking in opposition to the homeschool oversight legislation at the hearing just a week and a half or so ago.
Your assumption should always be that parents are working in the best interests of their children. We really deserve far more respect and trust than this bill offers.
Again, that's Melissa Theberge, homeschool parent, speaking in opposition to the bill we're talking about now on the exchange, HB 1263, which would increase oversight and accountability of homeschoolers. Let's hear from you. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Jason, what's the bigger picture behind this bill? I mean, these efforts have been made before, but we were all kind of shocked by that story out of California, the homeschooling family, 13 kids shackled. This issue is coming up in other states this year, not just New Hampshire.
Yeah, there's been a, you know, sort of back and forth over the last dozen years about homeschooling and how much oversight, how little oversight. The California example, I think it was something that was anticipated by a lot of the homeschool parents who came to that hearing. And the one rebuttal of that idea I heard was case of the Larry Nassar, the U.S. gymnastics doctor. They said here was a guy who was inside an institution who had all kinds of, you know, supposed accountability and oversight, and look what happened there. So the argument being oversight doesn't necessarily equal better protection for kids. So,
all right. Well, I've got a couple emails I want to share with you after the break, and we'll talk more about this bill. You can continue to send us your thoughts, questions, comments. The email is exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, everything you wanted to know about taxes and fees in New Hampshire, including the surprising and unique. Send us your questions by email before the show to exchange@nhpr.org. This hour, we've been looking at two education bills that have received a lot of attention this year. Right now, we're looking at a homeschooling accountability bill called HB 1263. Let's get your thoughts in. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Helping us out this hour, two education reporters, Lola Dufort with the Concord Monitor and Jason Moon with us here at NHPR. And both of you, lots of emails coming in on this, and here's one from Peggy in Center Harbor. She says, education department oversight of homeschool education is just common sense. It used to be done. Why did it stop? Most homeschool families are responsible and see that their children progress, but there are always exceptions, and some children are not being educated at all, Peggy says, and are in abusive situations. She says, where is the protection for these kids? If you are responsibly educating your kids at home, then you should have no problem with your local school district evaluating them a few times a year to assure that they are progressing in their learning. So that's Peggy in Center Harbor. Is she right, Lola? Did New Hampshire used to oversee homeschooling more than it does now?
Yeah, absolutely. Like a lot of other states, New Hampshire used to have much stricter oversight over homeschoolers and now has extremely lax regulations.
And why did that sort of come about?
There's been like a slow chipping away at homeschooling regulations, but before parents used to actually have to submit the curriculum for the year that they were going to use. They had to submit annual evaluations. And then since I think basically 2012, now, you know, you don't have to show any work to anybody. The Berlin superintendent, who actually asked for this bill to be filed, has said that homeschooling, the number of homeschoolers has kind of ballooned since the regulations were rolled back, and that she's actively worried about quite a few kids. And the analogy she uses is, you know, it's like having a speed limit, but there are no state troopers checking and ever giving tickets. So I've talked to national reform advocates. There's the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, which is all homeschooling alumni who advocate for having at least at the minimum annual evaluations of kids by mandatory reporters to at least catch like egregious abuses.
That's interesting. So the impetus for this bill came from the superintendent of Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Jason, did you want to jump in, too, on this sort of ebb and flow that we've seen around this topic?
Yeah, I think you can point to a pretty singular cause for a lot of these rollbacks, which is that the homeschool lobby got organized. Parents got together, and were aided by groups like the Homeschool Legal Defense Fund. I'm getting the acronym wrong. But they, you know, these are now national groups that have state chapters and are, you know, very they're up on the law. They're up on who their legislators are, and they advocate and they lobby. And the hearing last week or whenever it was a great example of that. They get, you know, they have a lot of sway in the legislature because they show up.
Well, and we heard from a parent at that hearing a moment ago. Let's hear now from Republican Representative Dan Itza speaking in opposition to this homeschool oversight legislation.
People who are home educating are doing it because they don't want to be involved with the government. And for the government to say, but you have to anyway, that's a problem, especially when our form of government puts the first onus on parents.
Again, that's Republican Representative Dan Itza. So that gets to what you said earlier, Lola, that, you know, it's insulting maybe to these homeschool families that the whole reason they're homeschooling is because they don't want government oversight. So for the government to come in and say, hey, we're going to do more oversight, that kind of, as Representative Itza sees it, goes against the whole reason for homeschooling in the first place.
Right. I think I've talked to a lot of homeschoolers, and there's often a feeling like at the minimum, the non-homeschooling community just kind of doesn't get what they're doing. I spoke to the chair of the Home Education Advisory Council, and I think he put it kind of like, we don't want someone who we're not sure understands what we're doing telling us what to do.
Which is kind of the point that he makes in that clip. Here's another email that came in. This is from Susan in Durham. She says, I have taught for 27 years, 12 of them as a reading specialist with students of all grades. Susan says, I've worked with a number of students who were homeschooled and failed to learn to read. I and my colleagues were able to teach those students to read, but it is very hard to make up the number of reading opportunities lost when reading skills are acquired one or more years behind schedule. Susan says if homeschooled children were given regular assessments, parents could know if their children were meeting benchmarks for the grade. So that's from Susan. Donna in Concord has a question. Do homeschoolers and charter school students have to take the state tests that are mandated for public schools? And if not, why not? Jason, do you know?
Well, homeschoolers, they don't have to. No, they can. They can use the state assessment as an option for their annual assessment. But again, they don't have to share the results with anyone. It's just for the parents' benefit to see how their child is progressing from year to year. And you know, it's one of the many things they don't have to share at all. You know, really the only contact a homeschool family is required to have with the state right now is one time, and that's when they inform the state that we're going to homeschool. And after that, the state can't compel them, you know, to get any information.
Lola?
And they actually don't even have to tell the state. They can also tell a non-public school principal or their local district. So actually, we have no idea how many people are homeschooling in the state of New Hampshire. The DOE has, like, stopped trying to keep track. The last count was, I think, in 2014, and it was, like, 5,900, which is actually a really large number. I mean, that's twice.
In a small state.
Yeah, that's twice as many kids that we have in charter schools. And think about how often we talk about charter schools compared to homeschooling.
So if you want to homeschool, just to make sure I got what you said right, Jason, you need to notify somebody one time.
And that's it.
And that somebody doesn't necessarily have to be the head of your local district?
That's right. That's right. So you just say, we're going to homeschool, and that's it. And that's a victory that the homeschool lobby won in 2011, 2012, the last time these were changed. And they don't, here they are fighting to keep it that way. That's how they like it.
Lots of emails coming in again, and I want to invite everybody to send us your thoughts by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Catherine that came in. She says, when I homeschooled my children for second, fourth, and fifth grade almost 20 years ago, I was never required to produce any evidence. Homeschooling required intense preparation. On a dime, I could have produced what should have been required. That oversight would not have offended me. One cannot say most homeschooling parents are responsible, Catherine says. There are no checks and balances to prove the statement. Many parents unschool, she puts in quotes, which is simply doing nothing. This is from Kathy in Conway, who homeschooled her kids. Kathy, thank you for that. And here's one from Tom in Exeter. Regarding homeschooling, it seems reasonable to ask for a level of accountability. A parent could honestly, quote, think they're doing the best for their child, but maybe they actually aren't. A measure of accountability, Tom says, could go a long way in helping them assure that they are doing the best for their child. So a couple emails there from folks who say, sure, why not? But Lola, again, at the hearing, the vast majority of people said no.
Right. I mean, I think the experience of homeschoolers that are really involved in their kids' education is that they do a good job. All the people they know do a good job. And so it's hard for them to imagine that, there are all these kids who are not getting an education. I think it's also at a certain level just philosophical. You know, when you press a lot of parents about, well, I mean, there must be some kids who aren't getting what they need. You know, they say, well, ultimately the onus is on the parents. It's not the government's responsibility. And of course, people who want oversight say it's absolutely the government's responsibility to make sure that every kid is getting at least the minimum.
Go ahead, Jason.
And this kind of ties into the broader philosophical debate about SB 193, this education savings accounts bill, which it's all about what is the state's responsibility in public education? You know, is it to put all kids in one school system and give them all the same services, or is it to give them, you know, the freedom to do these different things, to go to private school, to home educate? Where does the state's responsibility end? Where does the parents begin? Is that sort of the crux of it all?
What's the next step, Jason, for this homeschooling accountability show? As you said, Bill, you said earlier, lots of opposition, not very many supporters at that hearing.
Yeah, I can't. I have a hard time imagining it getting out of committee with a positive recommendation. But, you know, that said, it will come out of committee, and I expect it will die on the floor of the House. I just can't imagine with that much, you know, with the pushback that was there, with the very visible show of force, if you could put it that way, from homeschool parents, homeschool families. You know, there's a reason the laws are as lax as they are regarding homeschooling, and, you know, that was on display at the last hearing.
What do you think, Lola?
Yeah, I think with the political capital you would have to spend to pass this bill, especially with Republican majorities that are extremely choice-friendly, I don't think this is going to go anywhere, at least not this session.
So this is part of the whole school choice movement that we've seen in recent years. And Betsy DeVos at the Federal Department of Education, Governor Sununu here in New Hampshire, both big supporters of the idea of school choice. This sort of fits into that.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, and it's a movement with a lot of forward momentum behind it, so especially in New Hampshire.
Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. So both of you just have a couple minutes left. Lots and lots of education bills. We just talked about two of them in the interest of time today. But Jason, we could have talked about so much more. What other education proposals are you tracking in the legislature this year?
Well, one thing I will be curious to see, which is actually out of the legislature now, will be the impact of the so-called kindergarten bill. You know, now we have full day kindergarten grants supplied by the state, you know, funded by Keno gambling income. I'm curious to see how that's going to play out in communities around the state, because it's still up to local communities to decide if they want to have full day kindergarten. Now that there's this extra sweetener from Keno, you know, will that, how big of an impact will that be? Are we going to see, you know, on town meeting day an explosion of full day kindergarten across the state, or is it going to, you know, continue to be the kind of steady growth, you know, one town, two towns at a time, that sort of thing. So we'll see. You know, it looks like based on the revenue from the Keno, you know, earnings so far in the cities that have approved it, they say it's ahead of schedule. So, you know, it seems like there's plenty of money coming in for these kindergarten grants. But as a lot of towns will tell you, especially property poor towns, or towns that have a lot of kids and growing enrollment, it's not just the state grant per child that matters. You know, some towns don't have room for a full day kindergarten. They can't fit all the kids in one building at the same time, so they have to split them up and do half in the morning and half in the afternoon. And the Keno kindergarten money is not going to help them pay for a new school building. So
it helps on a per child basis, but it's not going to build a whole new couple classrooms
exactly.
to accommodate kindergartners.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of superintendents, you know, will take the view that, you know, well, you know, the state used to help with school building aid and the state would have covered a lot of those costs. Now they want to pass this education savings account bill and they won't pay for that. You know, so it all kind of gets into this, well, why are you willing to pay for that if not for this sort of tit for tat in the education world? But I'll be curious to see how much, if at all, the Keno money, you know, affects the choices for individual towns.
That is interesting. And just remind us, Jason, so in the November city elections, cities around New Hampshire had the opportunity to say yes or no.
Right.
Most of them said yes.
Most did. I think all but two.
And then in town meeting season, that's when towns will get a chance
right.
to say
that's
yes
right.
or no.
And it's up to each town to decide whether they allow Keno in their community. But regardless of whether you allow Keno, you get the money for kindergarten. So you don't have to approve Keno to get kindergarten funding.
Right. You're held harmless, so to speak. Let's take a call, folks. And this is Courtney in Tuftonboro. Hi, Courtney. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to present some thoughts and an opinion. I am a New Hampshire State Certified teacher, and I choose to homeschool my four children. And my opinion is I am okay with sharing what we do, but I do have a problem with being told that it's not working and that my program must end because my children are not at a certain number.
So you're okay with the oversight, but you're not okay with someone coming back and saying, no, Courtney, you're not doing a good job and you have to send your kids back to the public school.
Correct.
Have you run into, in your work as a homeschooling parent, parents who aren't as savvy as you are? I mean, you said you're a certified teacher, so you definitely know what you're doing there.
there are people that seek out extra support, but that's something that homeschool families do, and we have the freedom to do that, that if something isn't working, we can seek out additional resources or seek out professionals if we need to.
You know, one of our guests, Lola Dufort, said something interesting. She said there was a feeling at the hearing by people who homeschool that the supporters of this bill just don't get it. They don't get what you do, and that's the problem. Do you feel that way?
Yes. I got really excited when I heard somebody say that, because, and that's where I have a problem, is we're trying to accomplish something different than what the public schools are. So it doesn't quite make sense to be held to the same standards if we're, our outcomes are different.
Okay. Well, Courtney, thank you for calling in. I'm going to let you go in the interest of time. I appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Last question for you, Lola, too. Same question that I asked Jason. We talked a lot about SB 193, the education savings accounts. We talked a lot about the homeschool oversight bill. Other education-related legislation that you're looking at this year that you think is interesting?
There's actually another homeschooling bill. Well, it's not exactly a homeschooling bill, but it would remove kind of educational neglect from the Child Protection Act. Representative Howell is sponsoring it. You know, he says it's because he doesn't think DCYF should be investigating cases of educational neglect. It should be the local truancy officers. Opponents, including the Home Education Advisory Council, says this basically just legalizes educational neglect. So that's going to be interesting.
Are you also looking at kindergarten? Like Jason.
Yeah, I think there's a good chance Concord, for example, will go ahead and start full-day kindergarten next year, partly thanks to the money, but I think it's, I mean, other things lined up for them too. So I think, like what you said, I think it will help, and people that already wanted to do it will do it, and people who really can't do it because of, you know, they need to build a new classroom will you know, still hold off.
All right. Both of you, thank you very much for being here today. I really appreciate it. Lola, thanks a lot.
No problem.
Lola Dufort, she's an education reporter with the Concord Monitor. Jason, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
Jason Moon, he covers education for us here at NHPR. And remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.